Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, everyone. It's really great to be here today, and I'm so glad you're here for the most exciting panel of the day, the cyber panel. And I say that because cyber has come up in every single panel we've heard this morning, as I'm sure you've heard too. But also exciting because who would have thought a year ago in this room, by the end of 2023, we would have had four 144A cyber catastrophe bonds. I don't think anyone in this room would have thought that had happened, but it is what happened. And thanks in a large part to the hard work of the people that I have here on the panel with me and the organizations they represent. So while $114 million cleared the market at the end of Q4 in cyber ILS, and while that's a very impressive start, the reality is, I believe, is the 144A cyber market will have to grow significantly if it's to support the growth ambitions of the cyber insurance market. Or put another way, if the cyber insurance market wants to make its large growth projections, it's going to need alternative capital and the ILS technology that we have in the market. I've been working in new markets my whole career. And cyber really is a bit of a unicorn product. It's not mandatory yet. It is mandatory if you're a contractor for the federal government. Even if you mow the lawn, you need the cyber insurance policy. But in general, it's not mandatory, yet companies still see the value of buying this product and are increasingly interconnected in the digital world. Back in 2016, I believe the global insurance premium was $1.3 billion, according to AM Best. Today, we're around $15 billion, to use round numbers. I think S&P projects that will grow at 25% a year to get to $23 billion in 2025. And if you start growing that out by 25% a year for the next few years, the numbers start getting very large, as I'm sure some of you read, with some estimating that it will be bigger than property, commercial property, by 2040, getting to $480 billion. But cyber is very different from property. Property is obviously geographically diverse. A hurricane's not going to hit New York, London, Tokyo at the same time, but a virulent malware could potentially do that. And that means for a much smaller premium base, traditional balance sheets are going to start reaching their risk tolerance limits. And let's just think about reinsurance. So I think the global dedicated reinsurance capital base out there right now is around $450 billion, according to AM Best. We know not all of that is at risk to one event, so the threat, the solvency of the sector isn't threatened by one event, but say about 10% of that is available for any one event. So once you can imagine a cyber event that can cause $40 billion of damage in one go, you're essentially there. You're at the risk tolerance limits of the reinsurance space. Last year, Guy Carpenter released a report using the CyberCube model, estimating the 1 in 200-year PML for the cyber insurance industry globally in 2023 to be $30 billion. So while not all of that is reinsured and while not all reinsurers are yet involved in the market, that number is getting pretty close to that $40 billion. And if we were talking about a market that's growing so rapidly, very soon it will get there. And traditional reinsurance balance sheets will reach those same risk tolerance limits that they did for hurricane and earthquake many years ago. And cyber will become a peak peril. And what's the solution to the peak peril problem? Well, that's the capital markets, and it's the ILS market that doesn't have the same constraints as traditional balance sheets. So if the cyber insurance market is going to demand this capital from our space, how is that going to happen? How is a $415 million market grow to clear $10 billion, $20 billion, $30 billion a year? And to discuss that with me, I have my great panel. So thank you very much, guys. With me, I have Carl Freeman, who is the head of ILS structuring at Axis Capital. Axis issued the first full 144A cyber catastrophe bond in November last year. Next to Carl, we have Richard Gray, who's the head of third-party capital at Beazley. Beazley, of course, issued a private cyber cat bond at the start of last year, and then followed that up with a full 144A also in November. Next to Richard Gray, we have Richard Penny. Just to confuse everyone, we have two Richards on the panel today, the CEO of ILS at Aon. Aon bought two of the four cyber catastrophe bonds to the market this year. And last but not least, we've got Brittany Baker, who's the Vice President of Solutions Consulting at CyberCube. CyberCube was the official modeler on three of the four deals. So before we start talking about the future, guys, let's talk about 2023 and how that year evolved, because I said it was quite a surprising and exciting year. And let's start with the two sponsors, so Carl and Richard Gray. First of all, I have two questions for you. The first is, do you agree with this, these structural dynamics at play that I talked about with the cyber insurance market? That's my first question, and maybe it's a leading question. The second question is, why did Axis and Beazley both dedicate the time, the effort, the resources to kickstart this 144A cyber market this year? Kyle, you can start.
Thanks, Joe. So yeah, I certainly agree with your structural dynamics premise. It's not necessarily something that we needed immediately, but we definitely saw in the future, in very near future, the need for additional sources of capacity. Traditional markets are starting to get stretched a little thin, and you know, the typical program for an insurer is going to be a quota share, could be a sizable quota share, maybe with an aggregate stop loss on top of that. So there's two components to it, to my answer. First one is yes, as cyber grows, as the insurers are taking on more risk, reinsurers are starting to get a little stretched thin. And we foresaw that come next couple years, we're going to need that additional source of capacity, which I think is something you should always be looking for anyway. You always want to have more than one pot of money to go to in case something were to go wrong. If you had a large event, you don't know which one is going to be functioning properly. So you want to have multiple options. But also, in the last couple of years, we've seen a large increase in pricing on the insurance side. And that's helped insurers, along with some innovation on their part, get more comfortable with the attritional side of risk. So they've had some ability to lessen up on the quota shares, take that more on their own balance sheets, and then look for outlets for the tail. And cap bonds, of course, fit that bill properly.
Richard Gray?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'd easily disagree with what Kyle's saying. I think perhaps the issue is slightly more immediate for us because we're bigger and we're bigger market, part of the market share. But we have no shortage of quota share out there. There's lots of people given our performance within our cyber division who want to quota share with us. But the real issue, and obviously this comes back to the capital modeling point that you raised initially, is that there isn't a tremendous amount of excess of loss out there. And therefore, we need the cyber ALS market to sit alongside the traditional excess of loss market and obviously enable us to grow, and not grow for growth's sake, but because the demand is there. I mean, you say, it's not yet mandatory, but it's seen as a critical part of risk management for most enterprises. And so, yeah, it will continue to grow. We will continue to innovate. We will continue to be part of that growth. And to do that, we have to have the appropriate capital available.
Brittany, none of this could have happened without the recent maturation of cyber models. And I don't know to what extent the audience is aware about the amount of investment, the significant amount of investment that has gone into the cyber modeling sphere for the past 3 to 5 years. It's come a really long way. Mm-hmm. What's fascinating to me is the numbers are really beginning to converge, yet the modeling firms, you come at it from completely different philosophies and different angles, and the differences we see are not so different amongst other perils that we look at in property. So tell us a bit about how 2023 went for you, and how did you see things change from where we were a year ago to where we got to at the end of the year as a modeler?
Yeah, so I think a year ago and even 2 years ago, the conversations that we were having with investors was still at the point of, you can't model cyber. And one of the things that CyberCube is really conscious of from the beginning is to put it in a box that looks familiar to investors. And so as we sat down and walked through the framework, people go, oh, that looks familiar. And that allows us to start from a base that's common and get into the specifics of cyber. And over the past year, we released our version 5 last summer, and our head of analytics was really focused and conscious about, well, what will the ILS market need, as well as the rest of the insurance industry? How can we be even more transparent to the documentation, thinking through all of our assumptions and knowing that if and when this market opened, it would be that next level of scrutiny and those next level of questions. And so we were really, really conscious to prepare for those types of questions and scrutiny and just that level of detail. We've always had it, but we knew that was coming and it was imminent.
And it happened during 2023. One, I think that was interesting for investors, and I don't know if everyone in the room knows, but both Axis and Beazley, both deals were remodeled by CyberCube and RMS using detailed exposure data. And if anyone knows in the cat bond market, that's a rare thing to do. That doesn't happen. Brittany, can you speak a little bit about why that would be valuable for investors when it comes to cyber?
I mean, it's so valuable. I'm an actuary at heart. I want multiple models. And so as much as I'm at CyberCube, I want to see other views. And we all know that's really important for investors too. And when you're given detailed exposure data, that just takes out another level of uncertainty of, well, maybe they made the wrong assumptions about what's actually in this book. Maybe they got the limit profiles wrong, or they pulled in the wrong companies. Specifically for CyberCube, what we love to see is being able to actually take those very specific risks in a book of business and match it up to known technology dependencies. And so now the model is moving away from market share assumptions, general actuarial assumptions, to being more specific where we can and where it makes sense. And that just brings additional confidence into those modeling results.
It was a great standard. Richard Penny, obviously there was a lot of investment in investor education by both the cyber modeling firms as well as the sponsors that were involved. A lot of time and effort went into talking to the investors about what they do and how they do it. What else was different from an Aon Securities perspective in terms of bringing these new risks to market? And tell us a bit about those investor conversations and again, how they evolved throughout the year.
Yeah, so I think the beauty of what has been achieved in the cyberspace is actually that the underlying product that investors are assuming represents and relates very closely to the property catastrophe bond. And that's because what we're talking about is actually pretty similar in the sense that the indemnity-based occurrence bonds have an event definition that really speaks to the fact that we are dealing with a cyber event that is truly catastrophic. And so when you look at the structuring and the way in which these transactions were put together, they do mirror and resemble what investors have been used to from the very beginning in the property cat space. And I think that speaks to the fact that this risk, whilst is completely different to natural catastrophe risk, lends itself to sit alongside and in a portfolio of property catastrophe bonds. So I think from a banker's perspective, what we had to do was really go on this journey of understanding what our clients were after in terms of coverage. And then what we had to do from ground up was work with CyberCube and the lawyers to adequately develop out the contracts and the coverage items, and then ensure that what was being modeled as in the expertised risk analysis was representative to what was being covered. And ultimately, we felt very good about that and that was what was achieved. And that was the fundamental component that would allow these deals to be successful. Now, I think, Joe, you and I were both on the last Artemis conference in London. Kyle,
wish I was there. I was not there. But
and a question was asked, were there deals going to be done in 2023? And I think everybody said yes. But the question was, you know, how much? And I think we would all agree that 400 plus million would be a very sizable amount that the market's been able to digest. And the way it did that was despite what some of the things were said this morning, the participation on the deals to date have been broad. We have large investors that are buying into the product because they see it as being accretive to their broader catastrophe bond investment. But we're also seeing multi-strat type investors see value because they look at cyber as an idiosyncratic risk that is truly diversifying, and ultimately investors care about one thing, and that is the margin that they're getting, and those that participated felt very comfortable that the margin that they were getting in these transactions was more than adequate and accretive to their overall portfolio. And that is further evidenced by the fact that that these bonds are now trading in the secondary market and have traded above par. So that would suggest that there is an underlying momentum and belief in the product that has been structured.
So did you strategically go out and speak to a deeper bench of investors during this whole process than normal, Richard? And what can you share about that?
Absolutely, absolutely. We believe in the product that has been structured. We believe in the coverage that is being afforded. Our clients, as a large cyber insurance and reinsurance broker, whether they be corporates or insurance companies or reinsurance companies, are expecting us to go and find this capacity, just given the growth that we're going to see in this market in future years. So we are actively going out and having these discussions. Our preference is to continue working with our very long-standing ILS relationships, but that doesn't stop us from getting out there and finding that capacity if the ILS markets are unable to pony up and ultimately satisfy that demand. So there is capacity available for this product, and we see it growing.
Joe, if I can add. Yeah. We did a couple educational sessions as well. We saw a tremendous amount of engagement from investors all across the spectrum of, we're already bought in, we know that we want to do it, we want to support the market, it has to be priced right, it has to be structured right, of course, but, and to the other side of the spectrum, to those who knew they wanted to get there, weren't there yet, but weren't quite on the fence, there were some who were on the fence, and even some who weren't there yet. They told us they weren't going to be able to invest. They knew that, but they knew that they needed to get there at some point. And they were willing to put in the time, the effort, and it was considerable, to start that process for themselves so that they can then inform their investor committees, their end investors as well. And it was tremendous seeing that level of engagement all across the investor spectrum.
That's great to hear. And it strikes me that getting an investor to put in that just that first $1 million, right? That's the key. Once you're there, then the challenge is to scale that to 10, 15, 20. But that first million, and did you see that, Richard Perret, in terms of people just dipping their toes in the water just to follow and to learn?
Yeah, I think broadly speaking, we'd say the way these bonds were put together and the investor participation, and these were not large issuances. They were anywhere between 75 and 150 million. But the way in which those order books filled, they looked a little bit like a property catastrophe bond investor list, in that you had a band of investors that knew that they liked the product and they came in with true conviction. You had those that were very comfortable and came in with smaller sizes, and then you had investors coming in with really observation lines to really start to understand the product and participate. So it was really across that spectrum, and yes, we found additional investors in the second bond that weren't in the first, but had managed to go through their internal checks, procedures, processes, due diligence, and got comfortable for that subsequent issuance. So in that sense, the momentum was fine in that context.
And Richard Gray, Beazley was in the market with a traditional property cat bond at the same time with your cyber cat bond. How were those investor discussions different? It was your first time as Beazley entering the cat bond market, so you had two at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the irony being is that, you know, we are better known for our activity in the cyber market because we've been a sort of a pioneering insurer there. But outside of the traditional London market, we're probably less well known on the property side. It was probably unusual we didn't have a cat bond, given the size of our underwriting book within the property universe. So, but with both processes, there was a degree of education. There's probably less education on the cyber side because we'd had the private bond the year before. But what was quite interesting, and I think just to kind of follow on from what Richard and Carl were saying, I would say for probably every single investor that actually invested in our 144A bond, there were probably another 8 or 9 investors that looked in detail. We did essentially 2 roadshows. We did a "This is Beazley, this is Cyber" roadshow, and then we did the sort of the traditional bond roadshow. There had been a number of people that looked at the private bond. Either they weren't comfortable with cyber, or they weren't comfortable with the fact that a sense of lower levels of liquidity. So that got a few people over moving to the 144A structure. But within that process, also a lot of people got more comfortable internally. And I suspect what we're also going to see, which I think is kind of reflecting what Richard was saying, is that as it matures, as it grows, as the perception of liquidity improves, then I think we're going to see a push and a pull on ILS investors. Either they're educating their clients and saying, look at the advantages, look at the risk margin, the potentially sort of non-correlating portfolio benefits of this, and also the end investors ringing up their ILS manager and saying, holy smoke, look at the rate online, why haven't I got some of that? So I think, you know, it's very, very early days. We're essentially, kind of not much more than kind of 18 months into this process, although obviously prior to that there were months, if not years, of preparation. But, you know, it's very early days, and as a market it will mature and it will continue to grow, and lots more people will get comfortable with the risk. And sorry, I'm sort of hogging the light, but just the comment that was being made earlier about the modelling. We had used CyberCube for our private bond. We used RMS for structural reasons on our 144A, but we did have CyberCube as the second view of risk. And what was really, really interesting from our perspective was that although, in essence, both modelling approaches were totally different, they came to within quite a narrow range in terms of expected losses and what have you. Now, that, I think, clearly to pay for that second view of risk, as we did, that's an additional expense, which, but we thought that was really necessary because obviously we want to grow this space. And by doing so, and by demonstrating that despite totally different starting points, you end up roughly in the same area, we thought that was really important, and I think it helped, get a few people over the line.
I think it certainly did, and it'll be interesting to see if that feature remains as we go forward. So let's talk about the future. So $415 million cleared the market in relatively orderly fashion, right? It quite calmly. So it's how do we get to that end point where the market is clearing 10, 20, 30 billion? Where do we start on that journey? And what have we learned from this journey that we've just been on in 2023 that can help us get there? I'll start with you at the end there, Brittany.
I think for us, it's continuing the education process and allowing investors to come and talk to us and see what the models are doing and how far they've come. Again, just dispelling kind of that thought that they're still not in the right place. I think everyone up here and those that participated disagrees with that. But not everyone has spent time with CyberCube, RMS, others to really see that and get their hands on it. So for us, it's continuing to be super open and sharing what we're seeing and how the models are built in that philosophy, and then helping translate it to this is what you'll see as new bonds are coming to market and the questions you should be asking and getting them comfortable. I think that's kind of CyberCube's role to play as we're moving forward, and we're trying to get more folks off the sidelines, regardless of if they're on the fence, starting to climb the fence, out in the field.
So you hear that, everyone. This is the time to ask CyberCube all the questions you have. And I know that RMS will say exactly the same thing.
Yes.
This is the time. They're willing to educate. And I would just say from an investor perspective, to be clear, I think only the market and the time will tell how we get to these big numbers that I just mentioned. But I think one thing that we should all do is, as a group in a collegial fashion, is to commit to educating ourselves about this new risk. And I think, and then reaping the benefits of that compounding education and experience that we'd get a result. And I think that's something that did happen, as we've just heard, very well in 2023, but it has to continue if we're going to solve this potential problem that the cyber insurance market may need from our market. Richard Penny, how do we get from where we are to something much bigger as a market?
I think the old saying of hasten slowly is something that we're going to have to acknowledge here. This is a new market. And the fact that the market digested $400 million in the last quarter was excellent. But we need to be realistic about the growth that is before us. And I think I think we're so fortunate to already have property catastrophe bonds as a perfect sort of older brother or older sister, so to speak, in how it built, because we've got to remember back to those early days of those very first catastrophe bonds. They came to market not many years after the very first property cat models were developed, right? So it's taken us 20, 25 years to get to $42 billion. We're just 25 years later on cyber, but the fundamentals are all there. The fundamentals we have, we have very significant investments in cyber modeling capabilities. We have lawyers that are very focused on coverage and event definitions, and it's not just ILS lawyers focused on this. They access their litigators and the broader part of cyber to really tackle some of these issues, and it's going to take time. What I can say is that there is true demand from our clients to really work and think laterally and creatively around how they build the capacity that will deal with the demand. And when we have that supply and demand dynamic, we feel really good that cyber has the potential to throw off some really nice margins for investors, and therefore we're going to continue to have that investor dialogue.
Richard Gray.
Well, I mean, I think if you look back to that first bond we did, the first ever catastrophe bond, we essentially got about 80 million or just over 80 million of limit. And now we're talking about the fact that there's 415. So, you know, we're talking essentially a quintupling of limit. Now, am I therefore suggesting that next year it's going to be 2 billion? No. But I think we will see growth. I think the growth will come. I mean, it has obviously been enabled somewhat by the use of 144A rather than a private transaction. you know, we're a competitive organization. When Axis went out there with the first ever 144A, which obviously was the title we wanted. We had Kyle-shaped dolls, and we were sticking pins in that. But on a serious point, it's really, really important that more than just one insurance company access this market in this particular class. So it's investor comfort, it's underlying capital provider comfort, it's the maturity of the modeling that we've talked about. It's a simple fact of, you know, I mean, one of the answers on a previous panel was time. It has to be time. There has to be a degree of maturity, acceptance, greater understanding. And I suspect at some stage, you know, we will need these products to be tested. And Richard was talking earlier about, you know, the sort of catastrophe nature of this. It really is. I mean, certainly if you look at where our bond attaches, that's, you know, that is genuinely catastrophic. You know, our biggest systemic experience, you know, so far is like $20 million, and our bond attaches at $500 million. So we're talking about something which is right in the tail. And people, I suspect, need to get comfortable that that is the case, that they're not actually, in essence, protecting our earnings, that they're just protecting our capital. And then once we get that, then I think we'll start to see a differentiation between different insurers and different styles and different business models and all the rest of it. Because I think, you know, certainly if you look at the bonds and the work that we've done with Gallagher in terms of trying to understand pricing for the four 144As at the end of last year, they're all essentially on the same curve. I don't think there's any great differentiation. Obviously, Beazley, we like to think that we're, you know, we're the best at what we do. Well, we know we're the best at what we do. But you know, on a serious point, there's no differentiation between the sponsors. And I think that will also come as well. So, you know, yeah, it's just time.
Kyle, how does the market grow?
I could definitely echo everything that's been said up here, education. We need to continue doing what we're doing. All of us, the market needs to be out in front of investors. We need to be out talking to each other, trying to figure out how we convey the information about cyber, the risk, the modeling, the insurers better and more deeply, get more people interested, not just investors, more sponsors. We need more sponsors. The market
sounds
will not
like
grow.
Richard has a few, though.
I think the overall dialogue remains really strong, because to Kyle's point, we need more sponsors to develop the market, but there is demand for capacity in the cyber market.
And the work we've done on transparency, you know, through the educational sessions, through one-on-one conversations, through marketing, but also in the transactions, providing ELTs that are much more in-depth than what we would normally see for a property deal. That's very helpful. We need to continue doing that. We need to keep developing our own ways of doing a 144A transaction. We have slightly different views amongst the four different deals on what the structure needs to look like. Let's keep pushing that. Figure out if there is a certain path or if there are multiple paths that are viable. So just continue doing what we're doing. I think we did a phenomenal job last year as a market. We can do better, and I know we will.
So Kyle, you mentioned, of course, three of the bonds were indemnity per mm-hmm. occurrence. There were some differences in them. Did we learn anything? It sounds like Richard Gray, you think there's still a lot to learn. Did we learn about what's a better event definition or different ways to structure these deals? Or is it too early?
I would say it's definitely too early. We think we did the best. You think you did the best. And we'll let the market make that determination, without a doubt.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But we can always get better at what we did.
Yeah, and there were all sorts of confusions around war wordings and everything else. Mm-hmm. So it's a very dynamic space. It's a very new, you know, relatively new class. It's definitely new as far as the ILS space is concerned. I think one of the things you've just raised, which I would like to add to my list, is, you know, in agreement with you, is transparency. Mm-hmm. Obviously, BZ were quite unusual in so much that because of the nature of our business and the fact that cyber, obviously, depending on where we are in sort of rating cycles in any one year, but essentially we have four reasonably equally sized divisions. So we have full transparency through our group public disclosure, or, you know, results, so people can see exactly what our cyber business is doing, have an understanding of what's happening at an attritional level. And I think that, you know, shining the light into cyber businesses, you know, again, will be just another bit of the jigsaw as far as investors are concerned.
And I think that, again, going back to last year, that is something that the sponsor did a good job really bringing to life, these cyber insurance policies, which we don't really see in property. Right. But we I think investors, if they really spent time to learn, really got a sense of how these products work, how you underwrite them, how they're dynamic. The cyber hygiene, the thought that goes into underwriting a risk, protecting a risk beforehand, monitoring risks during, helping risks respond. Is there anything that you're working on? It's a much more direct relationship with the end product, which I think is fascinating. Is there anything that you as sponsors can do with the product at the front end that could maybe help investors get more comfort down the road?
War exclusions. It's very dynamic right now. We need to, as an industry, kind of figure that out. We're working on it. We're making a lot of progress. London Market Association is helping us, but we're not there. We got a lot of work to do. And I think once we get there and everyone understands what will be covered in terms of war and what won't be covered, that's going to help ease a lot of tensions that are out there. Not just amongst investors, but amongst the sponsors as well. We all want to know what the answer is going to be, what's going to be in, what's going to be out. And there's still a lot of work there.
Richard Gray?
Yeah, I mean, I think each individual insurer has a slightly different business model. Beazley, our flagship product, is Beazley Breach Response, which, as the name suggests, is as much a service offering as it is, you know, a financial compensation arrangement. That's critical. We've built out, you know, a huge ecosystem which helps our insureds both pre and post attack, and that we will obviously continue to develop. We have a cyber threat council which has, you know, members and former members of intelligence agencies, etc., across the globe, former hackers, etc. So we're trying to stay one step ahead. And I think the other thing, which again, you know, looking at some of the outputs from Brittany's model and from RMS, is we need to kind of understand what it is that potentially makes capital providers nervous and then adjust our policies accordingly. So, you know, we've kind of figured out that, you know, quite a bit of risk aggregates in and around cloud outage. So then we have sublimits within certain, you know, parts of our products, which obviously helps in terms of pricing for the end user, but also helps in terms of our capital position. So you're right. There's lots that we can do, and you know, we you know, as part of our kind of commitment to the process, we had a lot of very senior cyber members of the cyber underwriting team, including you know, Paul, who runs the division. And so they got to listen to the feedback from the capital providers. So I think it means that they're in a situation where they're hearing what the capital providers require, and they're also obviously on their, you know, as part of their day job, they're listening to what the customers, and it's walking that tightrope.
So it'll be remiss of us on this panel not to mention the fourth cat bond that cleared the market at the end of last year, and that's Swiss Re, the deal that Swiss Re issued on behalf of Swiss Re's retrocessional cover, are based on a U.S. industry loss index by perils and cyber, AccuView. So it's exciting, actually, to see in this first round of cyber ILS, we had indemnity deals and an index deal in the first go-around. And Brittany, you were involved in that transaction. CyberCube was the model of it. How was that process of dealing with investors and dealing with the legal team different than working on the indemnity deals?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there might have been some expectations from investors or other stakeholders that, you know, this is simple, streamlined. We don't have to think about individual underwriting practices or how, you know, the sponsor is doing this business. But at the end of the day, like all of these, it was a first. Each one of these bonds had a first in some way. And so getting investors to understand this is how the cyber industry looks like, the U.S. cyber industry, this is what it looks like, this is what it includes, here's how we created the database, here's how it interacts with cyber AccuView and perils and how they're going to report on this index. That was a huge learning experience and something that we weren't really able to do before that transaction came to market. You know, we all put in a lot of legwork prior years, but this was a very transaction-specific conversation of things that were just being created, you know, in the year prior. And so that was definitely interesting. There were a lot of questions on how it was all going to flow together. And one of the things that is hard, you know, we talk about experience and historical data. We don't have index responding because we haven't seen those big events, those hundreds of millions of dollars events. And so being able to explain how the exposure database reflects those and how the index would respond was definitely an interesting, kind of more challenging conversation to have and lots of conversations. But I think it really helped because even in the indemnity transactions, folks were asking, well, what's the industry loss that translates to these return periods? And so I think it was super helpful for investors to also get, this is what the industry loss looks like around those return periods. So I think it just shaped and made the whole experience that much more well-rounded for investors. And hopefully, Joe, you saw that.
Absolutely. So Richard Gray and Kyle, obviously, Axis and Beazley are founding members of Cyber AccuView as companies. And the whole point, Cyber AccuView is an industry consortium that's been set up for the US market to get better on things like war exclusions and wordings and bring some standardization to the primary cyber insurance market. And they collaborated with Perils to create the index. What are your thoughts of these kinds of index-based transactions?
First, I certainly applaud Swiss Re for getting out there with an index that was so young. And to Brittany's point, untested. As someone who is very fond of cyber AccuView, we want to see that succeed. As someone who also has a reinsurance cyber portfolio, we want to see that succeed because we very well may come to the market at some point with an index deal for cyber. It's early. We need some data. We need to kick the tires on Cyber AccuView, make sure that their processes are right, the data collection is right, and just test it. Make sure that it matches up with our understanding what the risk is, what the model's understanding what the risk is. It's not something that I personally would feel comfortable going to the market with right now. I don't need to, which is good. That matches up nicely. I want to see how it's going to perform under stress. But I'm certainly very appreciative of Swiss Re for going out there and getting the deal done.
Well, robust cyber, I mean, reinsurers are active in the property market for retrocessional risk, of course. Right. We need to figure out a way on how to bring them in, right?
For this cyber cap on market to really expand, we need to be able to involve everyone, including reinsurers.
Richard Gray, any thoughts? Richard Penny, any thoughts?
I'd definitely echo what Carl said. I thought, you know, again, with as Brittany explained, I thought it was really helpful to have those thoughts out there. As you say, we're one of the founding members of CyberAccuView, so we're really supportive of their activities. In terms of the way in which we approached our planning, I mean, ultimately, because we look at, you know, our cat bonds directly alongside our traditional reinsurance, because of the nature of our book, it's essentially primary. We don't have any, you know, delegated business to speak of. So having an indemnity bond just meant that, and an indemnity bond which is effectively mirrored our traditional excess of loss reinsurance was just the best, most effective, and easiest thing for us to do. It doesn't mean that it's, you know, it's the right answer for every reinsurer. It was just the answer for us. And I think, you know, when you talked about what's the future and the future growth, you know, there will be lots of different index deals and parametrics and everything else ahead of us, you know, but for the here and now, it was an indemnity bond that that we wanted. It was, you know, critical within the private bond and equally critical for the 144A.
Richard Penny, any sponsors wanting to do index deals?
Yeah, well, I think it's a further resemblance of the property cap market again, and it shows that these two markets can exist and have a lot in common. I think it's probably about a third of the cap bonds out there are PCS and perils industry index based in property. And already 25% almost of the cyber cap bond market is industry loss index. So there's a resemblance there. Yeah, so the reinsurers will need capacity in order to offer capacity to insurance companies. And the more the cap bond, the cyber market grows, the more they'll need capacity, and they're going to have to pay for it, right? So we view it as positive. I think where we what gives us momentum or we're excited about is that CyberAccuView is a consortium in order to talk about standards and improving the consistency and the overall approach to the cyber market. And that's fundamental in dealing with things like war exclusions, infrastructure, and these types of things. So, again, it's going to take some time, but it's absolutely positive for the market.
All right. I know cyber came up so many times before our session today, so I think we'll now go to the audience for some questions, because I have a feeling we'll have some. Any questions from the audience? It's Manjit. Somebody got Manjit's over here. Who's the? Oh, okay. We can
Paul's
go to Paul. You'll go next, Manjit.
Paul Arrett, Securus. It's maybe a naive question. Is it always possible in the past and the future to tell whether a given attack is caused by a state-sponsored actor? I know you have access to sort of FBI information and you know MI5, whatever, but is it always going to be possible to determine whether an attack is caused by a state-sponsored actor or not? And related to that question is, where's the onus of proof when there's a claim? Is it for the insured to prove that it wasn't a state-sponsored actor and therefore covered? Or is it for you to prove that it was caused by a state-sponsored actor and therefore not covered?
I'll take a stab at it first.
I can jump in.
No, we won't be able to always determine if it was a state-sponsored actor. There are protocols in place for trying to make that determination, but attribution is, by and away, the most difficult piece of implementing that war exclusion, and the onus is on the insurance company to make that determination and prove that it was so that they can invoke the clause. So that's the short answer. Yeah, and I think, larger
I mean, you know, this came up during our roadshow. I think the first thing is, you know, it exactly, you know, the onus would be on us to prove so that, you know, we are essentially guilty until, you know, proven innocent as far as reliance on that war clause is. But the other thing is that it's not just a simple, you know, state-sponsored, state-tolerated. It's, you know, if you had an organization that happens to be tolerated by a hostile government, I'm not going to kind of name them, but you know who they are, and that organization is involved in, let's say, a ransomware attack for purely commercial reasons, then the fact that they're tolerated by that host state, you know, doesn't trigger the war exclusion. So it's not just a sort of an association with a state. It is effectively that they need to be engaging on behalf of that state in a hostile act. So it's a little bit more subtle. I think, you know, given our intelligence network, which I've already outlined, you know, I suspect that, you know, the majority of times we would be able to attribute. We see it in other, you know, hostile acts, the Skripal poisoning and what have you, that, you know, national agencies are very quick to point the finger if they think that this is, you know, a hostile act of a nation state.
But is the virus or the malware, whatever, is there something in the signature of that that identifies where it's from, or is it, can it be completely sort of unknown origin?
I think very often there is a signature. I can't say 100% of the time, but very often there is.
Brittany, on that topic of the war exclusions, mm-hmm. can you say a little bit about how the modeling firms war is to a certain extent contemplated somewhere in the modeling. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk about that a little bit for the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. In the CyberCube model, we're looking at malicious attacks of all kinds, and that includes nation-state actors. What CyberCube does is thinks through the different types of threat actors. What I will say is for all of our perils and all of our scenarios, there isn't a single one that it can only be perpetrated by a nation-state actor. So folks will say, all right, which ones should I throw out? Which ones should I exclude? And my answer is none of them, off the base. We're not going to do that. But what our model does allow for flexibility with is if you do want to test your assumptions about the probability that it is a nation state actor, if you do want to kind of put a ring around that, a range around it, you can. And so our cyber intelligence experts do this all the time. They sit down one-on-one and have conversations to say, all right, of the 33 scenario classes, here are the handful that we think you should really zero in on that have the highest probability of being a nation state actor. And here's the part of the severity curve where that's going to hit. And so you can start understanding the impact of different war exclusions depending on how they're written. And we know there are different ways they're written, whether you need attribution from a governmental agency or a response from a group like FEMA, they can talk through as well, you know, based on the objectives and the actual impacts of this type of an event, what is likely going to happen. And none of that is certain, and there's a lot of, you know, gray area there, but it's a conversation we like having because we know it's helping folks like Kyle and Richard and other carriers think through, all right, these are the potential impacts of the language as it stands now, and if we want to change that in the future, what potential impact could that have?
I think Manjit had a question over here. I don't know where the microphone is.
Thanks. So two questions, the first one directed at Brittany. Mm-hmm. We've seen losses from different vendor models kind of starting to converge in the tail. Is that really a meeting of the minds, or do you think it's more just, you know, trying to give some comfort to the investor community, right? You know, one in 200 year event is 30 billion. What level of confidence would you associate with that kind of estimate? And the other question to the group, right, there were fundamental differences between the bonds from the Aon stable and the other bond, the Beasley bond. You know, Kyle, you alluded to it, we'll let the market decide. But wouldn't it make sense to, for the growth of the market, to try and come to a consistent level of event definitions and structure for the growth of the market?
I'll kick us off. The short answer is it was not, you know, CyberCube, RMS, or Science getting into a room and deciding to get closer. I think that would do a disservice. I think when you have multiple models, you want to see different perspectives, especially in an area like cyber today. What I do think is that as different groups have invested more time and resources in pulling the similar types of data, that's allowing us to get closer together. So I think it is helpful. I do think we all bring that different perspective that allows folks to say, all right, this is what I like from here, this is what I like from there. I think, you know, it's somewhere in the, maybe not the middle, but somewhere between the two. So that's definitely helpful. For us, our single point of failure intelligence data, those known technology dependency data, that's something we've had from the beginning, and being able to optimize using the known dependency data where it's easily observable, and then optimizing that with the use of market share data where technologies are a lot more hidden from eyes like ours or anyone else in this room, is something that was unique. And we see groups kind of coming around to thinking more similarly to that. Cyber aggregates at single points of failure. If you're going to aggregate cyber risk, it has to be around those technologies. And so that's something I've seen kind of converge, at least from where I'm sitting. But it definitely was not us kind of colluding together to try to make it easier on ourselves.
But these models will ebb and flow, and that's sure. That's what we've seen for 25 years in the property cap bond market too. You know, models will continually be updated, and new versions will develop, and we see that. We see that now with a new AIR model about to come out. It's just a further development in the overall ecosystem, and we will expect that. I think Manjit, with respect to your question on event definitions, yes, there are some different event definitions out there. And again, we saw that for years in the property cat bond market, where every cat bond that came out had a new structural mechanic. I remember the days where we didn't even have a variable reset in the way in which cat bonds were put together. And here we are today with much more flexibility. So we're going to see the mechanics of these bonds evolve over time, and that will be investor-led too, because investors are ultimately those that are assuming the making the cover or providing the cover, and we're looking for that feedback, and that feedback will come through direct feedback. It may come through pricing and so on, and we're at the start of that long journey potentially.
And just to add on to that. That feedback could be, you know, voting with your feet, saying I'm not touching it because I don't like the way it's structured, or it could be conversations after the fact, saying, you know, I supported one deal, but I like this structure better, or I'm comfortable with both, so it doesn't matter to me, where others may have a strong preference one way or the other. Talk to everybody. Let us know what your thoughts are. If you have a strong preference, we'd love to hear that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, and sorry, just to add to that, I mean, first of all, because we did the private bond, we'd had a huge amount of scrutiny on our wordings. And, you know, I thought quite reasonably believed that, you know, that scrutiny of some very sophisticated ILS investors was a pretty good forum to try and tease out some of those issues. But to the point I made earlier, we didn't want to be in a situation where we had almost like a sort of an arbitrage situation between our traditional and our cat bond reinsurance.
Any more questions? Yes, sir.
Traditionally, cyber has been considered pretty short tail. I was just wondering,
traditionally cyber has been pretty short tail. I was wondering if there were any trends in that one way or the other, and if that affects any of the economics going forward.
Certainly the way in which these bonds have been structured, I think to your point, it's fair to say that the presumption is this is fairly short-tailed. And if we think about where some of these bonds would attach, let's call it around a $10 billion industry loss, up to, you know, significantly higher than that, we are going to know when that event has happened. That will not be very latent. That will be not being able, you know, you won't be able to withdraw money out of the ATM, for example. Like it will be known. So the actual event will be somewhat short-tailed. Now, the way in which the event definition will be constructed, the event itself is considerably longer than an event of a hurricane or an earthquake. But at this stage, we do think it is a short-tailed based event that plays out over say 90 or 120 days, and then there's the maturation period where we have to ascertain and work out the losses. I think the one important thing to note about cyber and the way it differs to property cat is when that hurricane is coming up the coastline, you cannot stand on the shores and wish it away. On cyber, and Brittany can talk to it, there is a lot that companies can do to mitigate and reduce the risk of an active cyber threat, right? So it's a very different dynamic in that sense, but the way in which the industry is developing is a very significant effort around mitigating and reducing those threats as they unfold.
I mean, I did quite a lot of work prior to joining Beazley as an external capital provider trying to understand the length of the tail, and I think I'd slightly disagree. I think traditionally it was thought of as a medium, perhaps even a sort of long tail classic casualty type business. I think ransomware, cloud outage, all of these things are significantly shorter. I mean, ransomware is a very, very short tail business. So I think the tail's actually shortened as a result of the developments in the cyber threats.
And I think we found that short-tailed property isn't quite as short-tailed as we had once hoped it was.
Sure. Any more questions? Yes.
Yeah. You've almost...
Oh, sorry. Okay. Cool.
Well. Hi. Oops. Bill Kinsley from WTW. I'd be interested in the panel's views in respect of large corporates. We've seen large corporates who have been unable to access, in the Nat Cat space, unable to get the capacity they require. And I appreciate it's not possible now, but does the panel see the cyber ILS market becoming available to large corporate buyers?
That's a very good point. I mean, there is only so much limit available for single companies. And so any thoughts from the panel on the ILS? I mean, it's a similar situation. There's only so much limit that can be put out from the insurers for one risk. The only place that can actually come from is probably, again, the capital markets. Any thoughts from the panel there, or Richard Penne? Or have you had any corporates approach you?
I would say that the dialogue, whether it be insurers, reinsurers, or corporates, is active. In that, to your point, Joe, you can only buy so much limit as a large corporate. The challenge is going to be the affordability. So, generally, insurance is, if you think about how much your home insurance costs relative to the limit that you buy, it's a little bit similar in this instance where, we have spreads anywhere between 9 and 13% in the cat bond market. Typically, corporates aren't really paying those levels of premium for the capacity that they're buying. So there's going to be an affordability question there that will have to be.
It'll be interesting to see if that can be solved through some kind of thinking of corporate debts and how having that fully funded capacity available when that disaster strikes for you, whether the economics may begin to start to make sense, but perhaps not. Brittany, do you provide any analytics for single risks?
Yeah, we provide analytics for single risk from your traditional attritional losses all the way through any systemic event that might hit them and major events to single companies. So we provide it. We've definitely had groups approach us for proofs of concept. So still feels a bit earlier stage, but there's definitely interest and folks who want to talk about it.
You had a question.
So at the risk of another naive question like the first one that kicked us off, I'm an allocator. I have to explain all of this to end investors who are all lay people. Talking about cat bonds, people have seen videos of houses getting blown over by wind, and you can imagine it costs $1 million to rebuild that house. What is the actual loss that cat bonds are reimbursing for? Is it just business interruption and lost revenue? Is it something more concrete than that? If it's lost revenue, that goes on forever until the business is bankrupt, right? It feels like a much more amorphous loss than cat. The Nat Cat. Can you help me?
It's fairly expansive, the amount of number of coverages that are being provided for business interruption, continued business interruption. There are similar constraints put on the policies just like there would be for property. It's not going to be indefinite. There's going to be some limitation. It could be temporal. It could be a dollar amount. It could be both. You're going to have incident response forensics involved in trying to understand what the problem is, how do we wall it off first, and how do we fix it, working with the internal IT organizations to understand if there's been data that's been stolen, encrypted, if you need to work on ransom. The list goes on and on. It's a different policy from property, but there are some similarities, especially on the BI/CBI side.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, when I think through the events that are in these bond layers or even above, you're seeing major cloud outages, malware type of events that are spreading like NotPetya through operating systems and being able to go through. Business interruption, contingent business interruption are definitely up there as leading drivers. But to Kyle's point, these products are set up so that it's not indefinite. And one of the good things about cyber, and I think one of the Richards mentioned it earlier, is you can react to it. You can have data backups. You can't back up your house and pull it out 2 days later. You can have your data backed up. And so maybe it takes you a couple days still, but it's there, even if it's fully destroyed. And so underwriting practices are asking these questions and saying, how frequently do you back up? Are you testing that you can go and get it? And then for some where, you know, a simple cloud outage, once AWS or Google Cloud gets that light switch turned back on, companies can be up and running, depending on the circumstances. So there are a lot of mitigating efforts that can go into these events that really take it from the, oh my God, Hollywood scenario, everyone's down for months and months, to, all right, things are starting to come back online pretty quickly, depending on the type of security posture that they have.
And to add on that, just briefly, patching cadence is one of the important criteria when you're underwriting a policy to make sure that, you know, a known fault isn't being, you know, sitting out there indefinitely, making sure that you have the updates that are going to protect you from known threats. Something that, to Richard's point earlier, we don't have on the property side, you know, other than the blue tarp after you have damage on your roof the first time and the next storm blows in. Here, it's different. We have preemptive ways to mitigate risk.
And ways to check they've mitigated. No, that's the thing. You know, you can tick on your form that I have shutters, et cetera, but you can't really check. Cyber promises to be one of the most transparent risks in the market, I think, for that reason, for what technology enables these days. I think we've run out of time. Thank you so much to my panel for a great discussion.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you.